including some residences. 23 people were dead, not counting the outlaws who died in the fighting, and another 7 or 8 were injured so badly Dr. Lloyd Fentress didn't expect them to pull through. One of the survivors was Deputy Bertie Phillips. Fentress sent word to Matt and Sam that Bertie wanted to see them. They had stayed up all night, helping with the wounded and fighting the fires. Their faces were grim with smoke, sweat, and dried blood, and their steps weary with exhaustion as they climbed the stairs to the second floor of the hotel, which was now a makeshift hospital. They poked around in the rubble of the marshal's office and jail until they found their hats, but they hadn't located their guns yet. Dr. Fentress met them at the top of the stairs and pointed to a door down the corridor.
Bertie's in room 11. I told him he needed to rest instead of talking to you fellas, but he insisted.
Is he going to recover from his wounds?
I'm a physician, not a gypsy fortune teller. But I'll say this, Bertie shouldn't have lived this long. I've stopped the bleeding and cleaned and bandaged the wounds. Little varmint's so stubborn, I'd say he's got a chance.
Thanks, Doc. We'll try not to tire him out too much.
You boys look like you could use some rest yourselves.
That'll have to wait.
They went down the hall and through an open door into the room where Bertie waited, halfway propped up in the hotel bed. Thick bandages were wrapped tightly around his body. His face was pale and drawn, but his eyes were open, and he seemed alert enough.
Are you fellas all right?
Might banged up and mighty tired, but other than that, I don't reckon we can complain.
Looks like you came through that dynamite blast pretty good.
Thanks to you. If you hadn't thrown those sticks out, we all would have been blown to Kingdom Come.
Yeah, as it is, it feels like the whole world fell on me.
Not the whole world, just a wall.
And it must have been you two dragged me out of there and got help for me. You saved my life.
The least we could do.
Not hardly. Not after the way the Marshal locked you up when that brawl in the Red Queen wasn't your fault.
You know that?
I figured as much. Buckner started a fight every time he came to town. Marshal Stryker knew that. He just wanted to be the one who locked up the famous Bodine and Two Wolves.
You knew that, but you didn't do anything about it?
What could I do? I worked for Marshal Stryker. And he was a good lawman, too, don't you think he wasn't? He was just, ambitious.
It's all right. Don't tire yourself out, Bertie. We promised the doctor we wouldn't upset you.
I ain't upset with you boys. I just hate to think about what those no-good outlaws have done to my town. Doc Fentress says they kidnapped some women.
5 that we know of, including Mayor Lowell's wife.
My God. Somebody's got to go after him.
You think anybody in this town is capable of tracking down an outlaw gang like that?
Nobody who lives here. But you two boys could do it. I've heard plenty about you fellas. You fought owl hoots and got mixed up in range wars and even helped out the Texas Rangers a time or two.
Maybe you should call in the Rangers now.
That'd mean sending a rider to the nearest telegraph office, and that's more than 40 miles away. By the time any Rangers could get here, those owl hoots would be long gone and their trail would be cold. Now, though, it'd be fresh enough for somebody to follow it.
Somebody meaning us?
Matt already thought the same thing himself, but he was reluctant to agree with what Bertie was asking. The odds against him and Sam would be overwhelming. Of course, that didn't stop them in the past. They rode right into some dust-ups where they might as well have been charging Hades with a bucket of water, and they made it out alive.
You can have the best horses in town, and if you need guns and ammunition, take whatever you need from Lowell's Emporium.
Owned by the mayor, I reckon.
That's right. I've already talked to him about this. He told me to deputize you and tell you the town will pay whatever you ask if you can get those prisoners away from the gang. Pay you a bounty for every one of those bastards you kill, too.
You're the marshal now?
That's right. Assuming I don't die from getting shot full of holes.
Matt didn't think that was going to happen. Bertie might look like a mousy little fella, but he demonstrated he was tough as wine leather.
I'd bet you a hat you'll pull through. We ain't deputies, though. And we ain't bounty hunters.
But there's nobody else who can do it.
Matt and Sam looked at each other. Sam shrugged.
I don't like the idea they carried those ladies off like that. It's like the rape of the Sabine women from Greek mythology. I read about it in Bullfinch.
Matt didn't know where Bullfinch was and didn't care.
I don't much cotton to varmints who try to blow me up, either.
Then you'll do it?
Keep your badges. We'll go after the bastards, but we don't need any 10 stars to do it.
We'll take you up on the offer of some extra horses and guns and ammunition, though, and enough supplies to keep us going for a while.
Take whatever you need. I'm sure the mayor will agree.
Did anybody see what direction those outlaws headed when they rode out of town?
I was told they rode south.
South it is, then. Give us an hour or so to get ready, and then we'll hit the trail.
The Dutchman's was a trading post run by a man named Hendrik van Gort. Situated atop the Cap Rock, the rugged escarpment meandering through West Texas separating the Staked Plains from the rest of the Lone Star State, it was a regular stop on the Owl Hoot Trail. The rangers tried to raid the trading post more than once and arrest the outlaws they found there, but they always came up empty-handed. Van Gort scattered a network of spies across West Texas, especially in towns such as Sweetwater and Big Spring near the Cap Rock. Anytime the rangers rode toward the Dutchman's, Van Gort's agents signaled him by means of mirrors. They could pass along a message for miles in a matter of minutes. Van Gort built a watchtower in one corner of the adobe compound housing the trading post, and one of his three Indian wives was always up there, scanning the countryside for a warning flash. At night, signal fires accomplished the same end. Safety was what drew outlaws to his isolated spot. Safety, the barrels of whiskey, the crates of guns, ammunition, and the fact Van Gort was nearly always willing to buy wide-looped cattle or other stolen goods. A steady stream of ill-gotten gains flowed through the trading post. Van Gort was a giant of a man, bald with a bushy blonde beard, grossly fat, and sloppy at first glance. But underneath the fat were slabs of muscle. The Dutchman could break the back of a strong man with his bare hands and was known to do so when he had to establish order at the trading post. Word of his strength and ruthlessness spread. Even the most notorious were on their best behavior at the Dutchman's. Deuce Mallory and his gang had been there before. Van Gort's guards recognized Mallory and his men when the outlaws rode up to the compound perched on the edge of the escarpment. Heavy wooden gates swung open. Mallory rode in, trailed by the rest of his bunch. They still had the women from Buckskin with them. The prisoners were bruised, their clothes were torn, and the dull, vacant-eyed expressions on their faces spoke eloquently of the pain and degradation they endured during their captivity. Mallory intended to release the women by now, but he was a shrewd leader who adapted to circumstances. He could tell the men didn't want to let them go just yet. He was willing to bend a little on his rule, but they would leave the prisoners here at the Dutchman's and let Van Gort handle getting them back to their homes. He'd probably manage to turn a profit on the deal, claiming he had to ransom them from Mallory's gang. He would demand to be reimbursed for his expense by the families of the prisoners before he turned them over. That was what Mallory figured anyway, so he was a little surprised when Van Gort stepped out onto the porch of the big main building, looked at the women, and scowled in displeasure. A sod roof with vines hung over the porch. The vines hung down in front of the porch, providing some added shade and coolness. Van Gort pushed past the vines, came down the steps, and waddled over to where Mallory and the others reined their mounts to a halt.
Mallory, what are you doing with those women?
Mallory thumbed his hat back on his thatch of bristly, copper-colored hair. He grinned.
They wanted to come with us when we rode through a place called Buckskin up north of here.
Van Gort's scowl didn't go away.
Yes, I can see how pleased they are to be accompanying you. I thought you knew better than this, Mallory.
The outlaw leaned forward in the saddle. His left hand rested easily on the horn, but his right didn't stray far from the butt of the holstered colt.
You got a rule against bringing women to your place, Van Gort?
Kidnapped women, yes. Men will tolerate many things. Robbery, dealing in stolen goods, even murder. But molesting decent women is not done.
Then you'll be happy to hear I'm going to leave them with you when we ride out. You can send them right back where they came from. Hell, you'll even be a hero for rescuing them from us.
He saw the light of avarice flare up in the Dutchman's pale blue eyes. Van Gort just hadn't thought it through before now. Slowly, he nodded.
Oh, I suppose I could make this gesture, out of the goodness of my heart, you understand.
And the fact that I've got more than 24 men to your handful of guards?
Van Gort's pale face never tanned or even sunburned, despite the fierce West Texas sun. But it flushed in anger sometimes, as it did now.
You know the rules now, Mallory. In the future, no more female captives.
I'll keep that in mind. Now, do I tell my men to dismount so they can go in and partake of your hospitality, or do we turn around and ride out?
Enter, my friends, and make yourselves at home.
That evening, Mallory sat at a table in the big barroom area of the trading post with Steve Larrabee, Gus Brody, Jacob Pine, and Carl Henderson. The four other men were the only surviving members of Mallory's original gang, and the ones he trusted to help him keep the rest of their wild bunch in line. They put away a considerable amount of tequila already. Upstairs, some of the other outlaws were availing themselves of the services of the whores who worked at the Dutchman's. Others were bidding a not-so-sweet farewell to the women carried off from Buckskin. Brody gave voice to the thought on all of their minds.
What next, Deuce? I know you said you were heading for Mexico, but there's a lot of territory between here and there. The boys are liable to want to make another raid before we get there.
Mallory tipped up the bottle and splashed more tequila in his glass. He took a sip of the fiery stuff.
I was thinking the same thing. We want to have plenty of money when we hit the Rio Grande. Mexico's a poor country. Might be pretty slim pickings on the other side of the river.
The outlaws gathered around the table, grinned in satisfaction at Mallory's answer.
That's what we were thinking, boss.
You got some town in mind already?
Fucking Before bastard. Mallory could answer, two men lurched into view, swinging brutal punches at each other. Mallory looked up with a frown and recognized them as Dave Ash and Mel Warren, two members of his gang. Put a bunch of liquored-up outlaws under the same roof and let them cut loose, and they were bound to be ruckuses. Mallory figured to just let Ash and Warren pound on each other until they got tired of it. But then Warren landed a lucky blow and sent Ash flying head over heels down the stairs. Ash clutched at his leg as he landed in a sprawled heap at the foot of the stairs. Mallory came to his feet.
What the hell's happened now?
He strode toward Ash, but before he could reach the injured man, Mel Warren rushed down the stairs, drawing his gun as he came.
I'll kill you, you son of a bitch!
My leg! My leg!
Mallory saw now that Ash's left leg was bent at an unnatural angle. The white, jagged, bloody end of a broken bone stuck out of his calf.
Warren, drop it!
Warren was too drunk and angry to pay any attention. He had cleared leather, and his gun was swinging in line to blast slugs down into Ash's body. Mallory's hand flickered. The slug ripped through Warren's left shoulder and flung him backward. He landed on the stairs and slid down several steps before coming to a stop.
Stop your belly aching. You're lucky I didn't just kill you. What the hell were you thinking, Mel? Fighting among ourselves is fine, but we don't shoot each other.
The other members of Mallory's inner circle came up behind him.
Ah, that looked like some pretty slick shooting to me, Deuce.
Ash is a good man. I couldn't let Mel just kill him.
Mallory felt a flash of irritation at having to explain his actions. He turned to the Dutchman who stood behind the bar.
Have somebody look after those two. They won't be able to ride for a while, so they'll have to stay here while they're healing up.
Yeah, but it will cost you extra, Mallory.
I'll take it out of their share of the loot.
He jerked his head toward his lieutenants.
Come on, let's get back to planning where we're going from here.
The five outlaws sat down and poured fresh drinks, while a couple of Van Gort's men came in and carried first Ash and then Warren off through a curtained doorway into a back room somewhere. Mallory was in a foul mood now.
I have a place in mind where we can strike next. There's a town right out on the Rio Grande, about halfway between Big Bend and El Paso. We'll hit it and ride out, and practically as soon as we leave town, we'll be across the river in Mexico.
Sounds perfect. What's the name of this place, boss?
From what I've heard, it's a lot rougher than it sounds. It's called Sweet Apple.
Far to the east of the Dutchman's, far, far to the east, in the wilds of Trenton, New Jersey, Seymour Standish stood stunned.
Oh, dear. Oh, my heavens.
He hoped he wasn't going to pass out right here in the offices of the company his late father had founded.
For God's sake, Seymour, you act like you've never seen a woman smoking a cigarette before.
Well, I haven't.
He pushed his spectacles up on his nose.
It's shocking. Scandalous.
Rebecca took another puff on the cigarette and then sidled closer to Seymour. He was all too aware of the way her long, honey-blonde hair hung down her back, the rosy glow of her cheeks and the sweet red lips that made him think of strawberries. Those lips were curved in a mischievous smile now.
Well, if you think that a girl sneaking a smoke every now and then is so scandalous, I better not tell you what else I've been known to do. It might be too much for your delicate widow sensibilities.
Seymour's face felt as hot as if the sun was shining directly on it, even though, in point of fact, he didn't see the sun all that much, spending most of his days inside as he did. The only time he got out was when he had to make a sales call on behalf of Standish Dry Goods, Inc., and he hated that because, there was no denying it, he was quite possibly the worst salesman in the history of the company, perhaps even the worst salesman in the history of dry goods. Rebecca was standing much too close to him. True, he was fond of her. He had been known to stare at her a bit too intently when she didn't know he was looking, and he was utterly ashamed of himself for some of the thoughts that went through his head at those moments. Thoughts of walking along a shade-dappled path with her on a warm spring day, perhaps even reaching over, if he dared, and slipping his hand into hers for a moment. He was smitten with her, but he told himself it was a pure, chaste affection, the sort best indulged from afar. Certainly not from a distance of a foot or so. Why, he could feel the warmth of her breath on his cheek, her tobacco-laden breath. She suddenly gave a disgusted shake of her head and moved back, as if she was waiting for something and was disappointed it didn't happen.
Did you want something, Seymour?
He was on firmer footing now. There was business to discuss. Not by much, but at least a little firmer.
I got a note that said my uncle wanted to see me.
Oh, yes, of course, I forgot.
Rebecca worked as Cornelius Standish's secretary. That was something else a bit scandalous, having a woman as a secretary. Evidently, it was becoming more common, but it seemed wrong to Seymour anyway.
I'll let him know you're here.
She disappeared a moment into the private office of the president of Standish Dry Goods.
You can go in. He's ready for you.
Thank you. I won't say anything to Uncle Cornelius about the... You know.
Rebecca rolled her eyes and turned away. Seymour squared his shoulders, which wasn't as easy as it sounded since they tended to slump naturally. He stepped into his uncle's office. It was a big room with lots of dark wood, dominated by a large desk. His uncle sat behind the desk, and even though it was several months since his father's death, Seymour still felt a little jolt when he looked at Cornelius. He felt the same sense of loss every time he stepped into this office and realized once again Benjamin Standish was gone. Seymour pushed his glasses up on his nose.
You, wanted to see me, sir?
Cornelius was 60 years old, beefy rather than slender like Seymour, with close-cropped white hair and a face like an angry hawk. He was the older brother, and Seymour always suspected it grated on his uncle to work for the younger, more successful Benjamin. Since Benjamin's wife, Seymour's mother, passed away some years earlier, upon Benjamin's death, the dry goods company was split between his son Seymour and his brother Cornelius. The will made it clear Cornelius was to be in charge of the company, however. Benjamin loved his son, of course, but he didn't allow love to blind him to the fact Seymour would run the business into the ground in no time. Some people were cut out to be in charge, some weren't. Seymour fell into the latter category.
Yes, yeah, Seymour. I've been thinking. The company's doing well, but we need to expand.
That makes sense. As long as we're not too aggressive about it. Father always said a company gets in trouble when it tries to grow too fast.
Cornelius scowled. He didn't like having his late brother's words thrown in his face, and Seymour knew that.
Well, you know, we have salesmen in the Midwestern states, and in most of the Western states and territories.
Yes, of course.
But one area in which our sales force is lacking is the western part of Texas.
Do people out there really need dry goods, sir?
Do they need dry goods? Of course they need dry goods. Everyone needs dry goods.
Yes, of course they do, of course.
That's why I'm sending you out there, to establish a foothold in that territory. Virgin territory, so to speak.
You're You're sending me to Texas?
That's right.
But Texas is the frontier, the wild frontier.
Oh, don't worry. I'm sure all those stories about the place are exaggerated. Anyway, the town I'm sending you to is very civilized. How could it be anything else with the name it has?
What? What is the name, Uncle Cornelius?
Cornelius leaned back in the big chair that threatened to swallow him and smiled.
It's called Sweet Apple, my boy. Sweet Apple, Texas. It's going to be the perfect place for you.
Cornelius Standish waited until after his stammering fool of a nephew was gone before he took a cigar from a humidor on the big desk and lighted it. Seymour always coughed and acted like he was choking whenever he was around cigar smoke. Standish didn't want to put up with the annoyance of listening to him. Rebecca stuck her honey blonde head into the room.
I gave Seymour the train tickets you had me purchase for him, Mr. Standish. He wasn't very happy about going to Texas, was he?
Standish lifted a hand and motioned for Rebecca to come into the office.
Shut the door.
She looked like she didn't much want to do that, but she closed it anyway and then stood with her hands behind her back, leaning against the door behind her. Standish admired the way the pose made her breasts push forward against her dress. And she knew perfectly well he was admiring her, too, the little minx. Standish took the cigar from his mouth.
What did he say?
Not much, really.
Rebecca straightened and came toward the desk.
Just that he was worried that he might let you down because he wasn't sure how well suited he was for a trip to Texas. But I could tell he was really worried about going to such a rugged and dangerous place.
A boy doesn't know the half of it. I made inquiries before I decided where to send him.
Standish leaned back in his chair and smiled in satisfaction.
Sweet Apple, Texas is the worst hellhole on the frontier. Someone is shot, stabbed, or beaten to death nearly every day there.
Then Seymour...
is doomed. He can barely take care of himself here in Trenton. He won't stand a chance in a place like Sweet Apple. It's perfect.
Indeed, he was proud of himself for having arrived at such an easy solution to a problem vexing him for quite a while. Even while his brother Benjamin lived, Cornelius Standish saw how ineffective, how downright useless his nephew Seymour was. Yet Benjamin gave him a place in the company. Why his brother did that, Cornelius would never know. Looking out for family was all well and good, but not when it interfered with making money. Cornelius hinted often enough that Standish Dry Goods, Inc. would be better off if they let Seymour go. Benjamin always stubbornly resisted the idea. Then Benjamin was dead, and Cornelius was in charge. The first thing he planned to do was to send his worthless nephew packing, until the terms of Benjamin's will made it clear they were to share the company. Cornelius would remain in charge of its day-to-day operations with the power to make all necessary business decisions. With one exception. Seymour would always have a place with Standish Dry Goods for however long he wanted it. That thorn in Cornelius's side irritated him no end, until the grand idea occurred to him. He might not have the power to fire Seymour, but he could send the boy to some place where he was bound to come to a bad end, some place like Sweet Apple, Texas. Once Seymour was gone, not only would Cornelius be rid of an annoyance, but the company would belong completely to him. Standish became aware Rebecca was biting at her lower lip as if something bothered her.
What is it?
Well, I was just thinking about Seymour.
Good Lord! You're not... smitten with the little bastard, are you?
Rebecca was an ambitious young woman. A female had to be ambitious to work her way into such a respected, important position as a businessman's private secretary, as she had been for Benjamin Standish. After his death, she started to play up to Seymour, no doubt thinking if she could worm her way into his affections, she could take advantage of his newly inherited wealth and power. Only Seymour had no real power, as Rebecca soon realized. She understood only one man in Standish Dry Goods, Inc. could do her any good. Cornelius. She would do well to forget any residual fondness she felt for Seymour.
Of course I'm not smitten with him, Mr. Standish. He just seems so innocent, so harmless. I'd hate to see anything bad happen to him.
He's not harmless. He costs this company money with his nervous bumbling. That's why he has to be dealt with.
Yes, but...
Are you going to cost this company money with your sympathy, Miss Jimerson? I wouldn't be pleased if something like that happened.
Of course not, sir. I would never do anything to harm Standish Dry Goods.
Good. You'll be home this evening, I take it?
Rebecca lived in a small cottage in a quiet neighborhood. Every month, Standish gave her cash to pay for the rent, so there would be no bank drafts or anything else to show his connection to the place. She nodded without meeting his eyes.
Yes, I'll be there.
Good. I'll probably be working late here in the office, but I might drop by there for a few minutes on my way home.
He would drop by there, all right. Despite being perhaps a bit too soft-hearted for her own good, Rebecca was a smart girl. She chose the right Standish. As long as she didn't do anything foolish, Cornelius would see to it that she didn't regret her choice, but if she ever crossed him... Well, he would hate to lose her services as a secretary, and otherwise. But as always, he would do what needed to be done. For the company's good, of course. After his father's death, Seymour moved out of the mansion, the family home as far back as he could remember. The place was just too big and rambling and empty for one man alone, even with servants there. Seymour, being a humble young man, didn't care to have a lot of servants around anyway. So he closed up the mansion and took a room in a modest but well-kept boarding house. He was there early that evening, packing for his trip to Texas. He wasn't quite sure what to put in his valise. What did one pack for a trip to an untamed wilderness? He already put in shirts and underwear and a gray tweed suit. He planned to wear the brown tweed on the train. His eyes moved to the sample case sitting in a corner of his room. It was fully packed with examples of every line of merchandise carried by the Standish Dry Goods Company, Inc. Seymour wondered how many stores there might be in Sweet Apple, Texas. Enough to justify the expense of a trip like the one on which his uncle was sending him? That seemed unlikely. Perhaps there were other towns in the vicinity where he could hawk the company's wares. He could use Sweet Apple as his base and hire a buggy to travel to all the other settlements in the area. Or perhaps rent a horse. That thought made a nervous frown appear on his face. That was how Westerners got around, wasn't it? From time to time, he read articles in Harper's Illustrated Weekly about the Wild West and saw drawings of cowboys riding huge stallions. On occasion, he perused a few dime novels, although they seemed too frivolous to him with their breathless, breakneck tales of gunmen and outlaws, savages and beautiful young women in constant need of rescue from one deadly peril or another. For all their luridness, Seymour believed the stories conveyed an absolutely accurate portrait of life in the West. As he thought, he closed his eyes and suppressed a groan of dismay. He would never fit in, and his trip would be an unmitigated failure. He was sure of it. But he couldn't refuse. Uncle Cornelius, after all, was in charge of the company. The instructions left by Seymour's father made that clear. Seymour must follow Cornelius's orders and make the best of the situation. He packed extra underwear in the valise, thinking he might need them before his trip west was completed.
Who is it?
Rebecca.
Seymour's eyes widened. What was she doing here? She'd never visited him before. The very idea she would show up now at his room was, well, unsettling, irregular. Yet a small tingle of pleasure went through Seymour at the sound of her voice. That was even more unsettling. He wondered briefly if he should send her away. But he was too much of a gentleman to do that.
Just a moment.
He couldn't receive a caller, especially a female one, in such an informal state. He slipped on his coat, tightened his tie, and went to the door. Rebecca smiled at him when he opened it.
Hello, Seymour.
She looked past him into the room.
Getting ready for your trip, I see?
Yes.
Seymour stood in the doorway and didn't budge. He slept in this room, after all. He couldn't very well invite a young woman into it. A young, unmarried woman.
Aren't you going to ask me to come in?
Why did she say that? Now Seymour's chivalry backed him into a corner.
Of course. Please come in.
Rebecca waited for a moment.
You'll have to step back before I can do that, Seymour.
Oh, yes, of course.
He moved out of the doorway. She walked into the room. She was dressed as she had at the office, only she added a jacket and a small, stylish hat perched neatly on her honey blonde hair. As she moved past him, Seymour caught a faint whiff of her perfume. The delicate scent made his pulse beat faster. He'd left the door standing wide open. That was the way his landlady would want it. She didn't approve of her boarders having callers of the opposite sex. That was the way Seymour wanted it, too. He believed it was always best in life to remove as many temptations to impropriety as possible. Rebecca held a package of some sort in her hands. It was wrapped in brown paper, tied up with a string, and about a foot long, 6 or 8 inches wide, and 3 or 4 inches deep. Seymour couldn't imagine what it was.
I brought something for you.
Rebecca held the package out toward him.
What is it?
Seymour made no move to take it just yet. Accepting presents from a young lady wasn't really a proper thing to do.
Something for your trip. Something you might need in Texas.
Seymour frowned and shook his head.
I believe I already have everything I'll need, but I certainly appreciate your thoughtfulness, Miss Jimerson.
Oh, for God's sake, take it.
Seymour had no choice but to do so. As he grasped the paper-wrapped package, he found it surprisingly heavy. He almost dropped it.
Don't open it now, but I want you to promise me you'll take it with you, Seymour. This is very important.
But what do I do with it once I get to Texas?
You'll know. Believe me, if you need it, and I have a feeling you will, you'll know.
He started to shake his head and press the package, whatever it was, back on her, but the look on her face stopped him. He could tell how important this was to her. Something very near to desperation was visible in her eyes.
All right. Whatever you wish, Miss Jemerson.
What I wish is that you'd call me Rebecca just once. What I wish is... Oh, I'm sorry, Seymour. I didn't want to place you in an awkward position by coming here this evening. And I have to go. I have to be somewhere else tonight. I have an engagement.
Oh, for dinner?
Something like that.
She reached out and touched his hand as it held the package she'd given him. Her fingers were soft and warm.
Promise me you'll take that with you and use it if you have to.
I suppose.
The nearness of her made Seymour's head spin until he had trouble getting the words out.
Promise?
I promise.
A sad smile touched Rebecca's lips.
All right. Thank you.
She moved closer still, came up on her toes, and brushed those lips against his cheek.
Goodbye, Seymour. And good luck.
The fact she kissed him shook Seymour to his core. Yet though he was ashamed to admit it to himself, he liked it. He liked it a lot. So much so that for a moment all he could do was blink his eyes and open and close his mouth.
Well, goodbye, Rebecca.
She turned away to leave, but paused in the doorway and looked back at him.
One more thing, Seymour, and this is very important, too. If you see your uncle before you leave Trenton, don't tell him I came here this evening.
Well, I don't think I'll be seeing him because the train leaves at 8:27 in the morning, so I won't be going to the office. I doubt Uncle Cornelius will come to see me off.
He was on firmer ground now. Concrete details like a train schedule always made him feel better. They weren't as nerve-wracking as things like a pounding heartbeat and the delicate scent of perfume and the warmth of a woman's hand.
You have to promise me that, too.
Of course. I won't say anything to Uncle Cornelius.
Thank you. Good luck, Seymour.
That was the second time she wished him luck, he thought, as she departed. He closed the door behind her. He was grateful, of course. Headed for the wild frontier as he was, he would take all the luck he could get. He would also take whatever was in the package she left with him, since he gave her his word he would. He frowned at it as he carried it over to the bed. She didn't make him promise he wouldn't open it up until he got to Texas, merely that he would take it along on the trip. So He gave in to his curiosity and began to untie the string holding the wrapping paper on the package. When he got it loose, he pulled the paper away to reveal a plain wooden box with a hinged lid. The lid had a simple clasp and no lock. Seymour unfastened the clasp and raised the lid. He stared down at the object resting inside the box on a bed of dark blue velvet shaped to hold it. The light from Seymour's lamp reflected from polished, nickel-plated iron. No wonder the box was heavy, Seymour thought, as his heart began to pound again, this time with fear. Inside the box was a gun. Matt Bodine and Sam Two Wolves were 3 days on the trail of the outlaw gang that raided Buckskin when they spotted smoke rising on the southern horizon in front of them. One of the problems with West Texas, everywhere was a hell of a long way from everywhere else. But now Matt and Sam appeared to be approaching civilization again, or at least what passed for civilization out here. The raiders didn't attempt to hide their tracks. That would be impossible anyway with such a large group. With every mile passing under their horses' hooves, the Blood Brothers worried they would come across the body of one or more of the women taken prisoner back in Buckskin and carried off from the settlement. So far, they made no such grisly discoveries.
Is that a town up there?
I don't think so. Looks more like a fort of some sort.
You mean an army fort?
No, more like a trading post. There appears to be an adobe wall around several buildings.
You can see that much without a spyglass?
Indian have eyes like hawk.
Indian full of shit. You don't see any better than I do, and we both know it.
I think that's the Dutchman's place. I've never been there, but I remember hearing someone talk about it one time when we were in El Paso.
Oh, yeah. Some sort of trading post for owl hoots, right?
That's right. The rangers have tried to close it down, but they've never been able to get any hard evidence against the man who runs it.
I think Finch said something about it one time, too.
Josiah Finch was a Texas Ranger, small in stature but big in fighting spirit. Matt and Sam pitched in to help him out on a couple of occasions.
That's right. Honest folks know to steer clear of the place.
But we're going, right?
The trail those raiders left leads straight there, looks like.
That answers my question, then.
Matt heeled his mount into a trot. It was possible the men they were after were still at the Dutchman's. He was eager to find out. The question remained. How could he and Sam, by themselves, take on 24 or more outlaws? As they neared the place, he saw a thick adobe wall about 10 feet tall surrounding a compound containing half a dozen buildings. One large building housed the trading post itself, Matt supposed, and scattered around it were smaller structures. A wooden watchtower rose in one corner next to the wall. Beyond the trading post, the ground fell away, dropping some 50 or 60 feet to another plain. It was as if, at some point in the dim, distant past, the land to the south and east of the jagged escarpment dropped suddenly. People called it the Caprock. The levelness of the terrain on both sides meant a person could see for 20 miles or more from up here. There wasn't much to see. A lot of flat, mostly sandy land, dotted with scrub brush, hardy clumps of grass, and the occasional mesquite tree. Sam waved a hand at the vast sweep of territory before them.
All of that used to be covered with water, you know.
Yeah? When was that? I don't recall hearing about it.
Millions of years ago. The Gulf of Mexico reached all the way up here. It was on this side of the Caprock, too. But whatever caused the escarpment to form caused the sea to drain, too. That's why you can find fossilized remains of fish and other sea creatures, the likes of which no human has ever seen living in these parts.
Learn about that in school, did you?
That's right.
Matt nodded toward the trading post, which was now only about 50 yards away.
Learn anything in school about what to do when folks start pointing guns at you?
Sam frowned as he saw his blood brother was right. Several men were standing on parapets inside the adobe wall of the compound, pointing rifles at them. Matt and Sam kept riding toward the heavy wooden gates, leading the two pack animals and the two extra saddle horses behind them. The gates swung open. As Matt and Sam rode in, they were aware of the men on the parapet tracking them with the rifles. More men were waiting for them on the ground inside, also armed with rifles. If this was a trap, it wouldn't be easy fighting their way out. They reined to a halt in front of the trading post's porch with its vine-covered roof.
Those outlaws are still here. Chances are they won't recognize us. The only ones who got a good look at us are dead.
So we pretend to be on the dodge ourselves until we get the lay of the land.
Yeah.
A big man came out of the building and pushed through the vines that dangled from the edge of the porch roof. He was bald with a bushy blonde beard. He was also the fattest hombre Matt and Sam had seen for quite a while. Rolls of fat bulged the white shirt and brown leather vest he wore.
Gentlemen, welcome to the Dutchman's. I am Hendrik von Gurt.
Name's Smith. This here's Jones.
I see. Many of your relatives have stopped here, yeah? I have only one question before you dismount and avail yourselves of my hospitality.
What's that?
You are not lawmen.
Not hardly, mister.
Matt was glad he and Sam refused to take those deputy badges offered to them back in Buckskin. Chances were, they and their gear would be searched for telltale tin stars.
You understand, of course. I cannot simply take your word for this.
Sam waved a hand in a casual gesture.
Look through our gear if you want. The only metals you'll find are lead, gold, and silver. And we keep close count of those.
I understand. Step down, and we shall see.
As Matt and Sam dismounted, the Dutchman motioned to several of his guards. The men came forward and pawed through the saddlebags and the supplies lashed to the pack horses, while the rest of the guards continued to cover Matt and Sam. Once that search was done, Van Gort's men checked the pockets of the two newcomers, too. Matt's eyes narrowed in anger, but he put up with the irritation. Finally, one of the men nodded to Van Gort, and the Dutchman broke into a gleaming smile.
Come in, gentlemen, come in. We have food and drink, and almost anything else you may desire.
What about women?
Of course. Most of them have Indian blood.
Van Gort looked at Sam.
But I would venture to guess, so do you, my young friend.
Sam didn't say anything as they went inside the cool, shadowy interior of the trading post.
I was talking more about white women.
He thought it was possible the outlaws left one or more of the prisoners from Buckskin here. Van Gort tugged at his beard. Matt saw greed warring with caution in the man's pale blue eyes. Greed won out.
Well, as a matter of fact, I do have several white women staying here at the moment who might be interested in some male companionship, if you'd like to see them.
Later. Right now, I want a beer and some grub more than anything else.
Yeah, me too. Maybe we'll take you up on the other later.
Of course. Have a seat at one of the tables. We have beans, un stew, and tortillas. Someone will bring the food to you, along with the beers.
Much obliged.
Sam and Matt sat down at a table in the corner, picking one so they could both sit with their backs to a wall, as men on the run from trouble would habitually do. They seemed to be the only customers at the moment. Matt took a look at the corral as they came in and didn't see any abundance of horses there. It was looking as if the Buckskin Raiders were no longer here. They probably stopped for a night or two, then moved on.
Don't rush things. You can't just waltz right into a place like this and start asking suspicious questions.
If we really were hard cases on the dodge, wouldn't it look more suspicious if we didn't want any women?
Just don't rush it. Van Gort probably has at least 10 or 12 men working for him.
Better odds than we thought they might be.
True. But let's see if we can get out of here without a big fight.
What's the fun in that?
A couple of Indian women appeared carrying bowls of stew, plates piled high with beans and tortillas, and mugs of beer. As Matt and Sam cleared the last morsels from their plates, Van Gort came into the trading post, approached the table, and nodded.
My men are caring for your animals.
And searching our gear more thoroughly, Matt thought. Sam waved a hand at one of the empty chairs.
Would you care to join us, sir?
Oh, I believe I will.
He flipped a pudgy hand at the Indian woman behind the bar. She brought a huge mug of beer over to him. Foam overflowed the top and dripped down the sides. The Dutchman smiled at Matt and Sam.
I like to get to know my visitors. So, Mr. Smith, Mr. Jones, what brings you to my trading post?
We're here for our health. We like the climate.
Yeah. It's not too hot here.
Most people would say West Texas is hotter than the hinges of hell. Yeah.
Well, there's hot, and then there's hot.
Well, I take your meaning, young sir. Are the Rangers after you?
Most folks on the frontier make a habit of not asking such personal questions.
Ah, yes, but I was not raised here, my friend. And I have a stake in knowing such things. The Rangers would like nothing better than to close my business down and arrest me for giving aid and comfort to fugitives they seek.
The Rangers aren't after us.
Well, in that case, you are welcome to avail yourselves of my hospitality for as long as you wish, and as long as you can pay. Now, since you appear to be almost finished with your meal, shall I send those women down?
Nat and Sam glanced at each other, then shrugged and nodded. The Dutchman seemed to have accepted them as being owl hoots. They could risk taking a look at the women now. If they turned out to be the prisoners taken from Buckskin, Matt thought it would be a good idea to go ahead and pay for a couple of them. They needed a chance to talk to the captives in private, find out the situation here, and make plans to get the women out of the Dutchman's clutches. Matt could tell by looking at Sam his blood brother thought the same. Together for so long, and through so much danger together, their brains tended to work the same way. Van Gort heaved his bulk out of the chair and waddled over to the bar. He spoke to the woman there, who came out from behind the bar and climbed a narrow set of stairs to the trading post's second floor. She returned a few moments later, and down the stairs behind her trailed several women, followed by a hard-faced guard with a rifle. Though the women's clothing was tattered and torn, their faces showed the hardship more. They had the cringing, fearful look of whipped dogs, Matt thought. Furious anger welled up inside him as he saw what had been done to them. The women weren't tied or chained in any way Matt could see. They didn't have to be restrained. Their spirits were broken. Van Gort stepped away from the bar and held out a hand to indicate the women.
Right, as you've requested. Take your pick, gentlemen. The price will be a bit higher, but well worth it, I assure you.
Matt managed to put a smile on his face despite the rage he felt. Sam did likewise. They stood up and approached the women. Five in all, the youngest about 15 or 16, the oldest in her 30s. Matt nodded toward a woman with tangled blonde hair, who appeared to be about 25.
I'll take her.
The Indian woman grasped the blonde's arm and shoved her toward Matt. He patted her shoulder as she stood in front of him, head bowed. He tried to make the gesture reassuring, but she flinched. He couldn't blame her for that. Sam selected the next to the oldest woman, a brunette. Her eyes flashed briefly as the Indian woman pushed her, a spark of defiance quickly extinguished by a thump to the head. Matt saw the muscle jumping a little in Sam's jaw and knew Sam was having trouble controlling his anger. Matt felt the same way himself, but they had to bide their time. Gunplay now wouldn't solve anything.
Their rooms are at the top of the stairs, gentlemen. Please enjoy yourselves.
We intend to. What's your name?
Matt and the woman were alone in a small room on the second floor of the trading post. The room had nothing in it but a narrow bed with a sagging mattress and one rickety-looking chair. The blonde didn't answer. She kept her eyes downcast and reached for the buttons of her dress.
No.
He touched her hand.
You don't have to do that.
I'll do anything you want, mister.
Listen to me.
Matt put his hand under her chin and tipped her head up until she had no choice but to look at him.
My name is Matt Bodine. The folks back in Buckskin sent me to help you.
For a second, she showed no reaction. Then suddenly, Matt saw something flash in her eyes.
Buckskin? You're from Buckskin?
Yes, ma'am. I've come to get you out of here.
Oh, my God.
She sagged against him as if every muscle in her body had gone limp at once. Matt had no choice but to put his arms around her and hold her up. She buried her face against his chest.
I prayed someone would come for such a long time, and then I gave up.
Somewhat awkwardly, Matt patted her on the back and tried to comfort her. He wasn't at his best with crying women. He suspected most hombres weren't. But he knew somehow the best thing he could do now was to just be patient. After a while, she seemed to cry herself out. She lifted her head and wiped the back of her hand across her nose in an unselfconscious gesture.
You said your name is Bodine?
Yes, ma'am. Matt Bodine.
I'm Alice Fletcher.
Even though her eyes lost the dull, uncaring look, they were still filled with worry.
What are you going to do? That awful man, that Van Gort, he has a lot of gunmen working for him.
Gunmen are something my brother and I have experience handling, ma'am.
Your brother? Well, there's more than one of you here.
Blood brother, actually. Name of Sam Two Wolves. He's in another of the rooms up here talking to one of the other women like I'm talking to you. The folks are eager to get y'all back.
Even as he spoke, he knew that wasn't necessarily true. Too often, Matt heard stories about white women rescued from captivity with the Indians, only to be shunned because they were forced to lay with the captors. Some of those unfortunates took their own lives because of the shame they felt. The real shame, the way Matt saw it, was people didn't have more sense.
What happened to the men who brought you here? Are they still around?
They left a couple of days ago. Van Gort struck some sort of deal with their leader. He was supposed to return us to Buckskin, I think, in exchange for some ransom money, but he decided to put us to work for a while first. That way he could make the most out of us, he said.
Matt's eyes narrowed. He was looking forward to the showdown with Van Gort.
Do you know where those outlaws were headed?
I have no idea.
What about their leader? You know who he was?
I heard his name mentioned. I think it was Mallory. The first name was odd. Deuce?
Deuce Mallory. That's right. I've heard of him, but never crossed trails with him. He's supposed to be mean as a devil, and the men who ride with him are just as bad.
Yes, they're devils, each and every one of them. Devils. You're not going after them, are you?
Sam and I sort of promised the folks back in Buckskin we'd try to even the score for them.
But there are too many outlaws. You wouldn't have a chance against them.
Sam and I are used to long odds. Anyway, that's going to have to wait until we make sure you and the other ladies are safe.
You take us back to Buckskin?
Matt hesitated. Turning around and taking the women all the way back to Buckskin would put him and Sam more than a week behind the outlaws. Still, what else could they do? Even after the women were freed from the Dutchmen, they couldn't be left alone to fend for themselves and get back home on their own. This was a problem, but Matt didn't see any solution to it.
We'll get you home.
What else could he say? She hugged him.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Bodine.
Something occurred to Alice. She looked up at him.
A couple of the outlaws are still here.
They are? How come they didn't go with the others?
Because they're both hurt. They got in some sort of fight. One of them was shot in the shoulder, and the other has a broken leg. Mallory left them behind to recuperate.
I wonder if they're supposed to meet up with the rest of the gang later.
Well, I wouldn't know about that.
I reckon there's a good chance they'd know where Mallory was headed anyway.
You and your blood brother are still going to go after them?
If we can. Right now, though, the main thing is to make sure all of you ladies are safe. You don't know for sure how many men the Dutchman has around here?
I've seen 8 or 9 of them, I think. And there are 6 Indian women. Van Gort calls several of them his wives. They're as bad as the men. They beat us and threaten to torture us.
I reckon the men are scattered all around the compound, too.
I don't know. We've been kept inside ever since we got here.
What they needed to do, Matt reflected, was get Van Gort and all of his men in one place. That way, maybe he and Sam could get the drop on the whole bunch at once. There had to be a way to do that. An idea flickered to life in his head.
Are all of you kept in the same room?
That's right. We're locked in together, and one of Van Gort's men is always right outside the door.
When you get back in there, tell the others who Sam and I are and why we're here. But make sure they understand they can't act any different than they've been acting. When you leave this room, you gotta look like you've given up hope, and you have to stay that way.
So Van Gort won't get the idea something's wrong.
That's right. Can you do that?
Oh, if it means getting out of here, I can.
All right. I reckon we've been in here long enough to have...
It's all right. I know what you mean. And you're right.
As Alice let out the breath, the light in her eyes died again. Her face took on a look of hopeless despair. Alice looked as broken in spirit and defeated as when Matt first saw her. What Matt needed now was a chance to talk privately with Sam and explain his idea. He went to the door and opened it, made a curt gesture for Alice to come out. She followed him meekly. The hard-faced guard lounged nearby with one shoulder propped against the wall. He straightened as Matt and the blonde emerged from the squalid little room. A leering grin appeared on his face. Sam came downstairs a few minutes after Matt did. He was alone, too, and Matt knew the prisoners were sequestered again.
How was it, Pilgrim?
Just fine. I got exactly what I needed.
Matt nodded, knowing what Sam meant. Sam's talk with the other woman went well.
You have any ideas about how to handle Van Gort and his men?
Not yet.
Well, it just so happens that I do. Let's go check on our horses.
Sure.
Sam got to his feet, too, and they started for the front door of the trading post.
Leafing already, gentlemen?
Not hardly. Just thought we'd go take a look at our horses.
They are in the corral and have been well cared for, I assure you.
I don't doubt that for a second, but Mr. Jones and I are right fond of the critters. They've carried us out of some mighty tight spots, if you know what I mean.
Of course. Feel free to come and go as you please. You are not prisoners here, after all.
Matt and Sam nodded and went on out as the Dutchman stepped aside. They strolled toward the barn and the corral next to it.
You reckon he's suspicious?
Fella like that, running a place like this? I'd bet a hat he's suspicious all the time. Of just about everybody.
What's the idea you had?
We set the barn on fire. Van Gort and everybody else goes running to put it out. That's when we get the drop on them. While they're all together and not paying any attention to us.
The barn's made of adobe. I don't think it's going to burn.
Everything that's inside it will, though. Especially any hay stored in there.
That's right. That might work. Especially if we wait until after dark to make our move. Nothing like a big fire in the night to attract a lot of attention.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Say we manage to disarm Van Gort and his men. What then?
Stampede their horses, drive them out of here, and finish burning the place down like the hellhole it is. Then we take the women back to Buckskin.
That's going to put us a long way behind the rest of the gang.
Can't be helped.
No, I suppose not. You know Van Gort's going to put up a fight.
Yeah, I know. After seeing those women and talking to the one who was with me, I almost hope he does. I know right where my first bullet's going.
They stopped at the corral and looked at their horses. The animals were as well cared for as Van Gort said. The sun was lowering in the western sky, so they had another couple of hours to wait until full darkness fell. Then one of them could slip out to the barn and start the blaze calculated to draw the Dutchman and his guards out of the trading post. Whoever stayed inside would have to deal with the Indian women, then join the other blood brother to corral Van Gort and his bunch of gunnies. They sat inside the trading post, nursing a couple of beers, killing time. Van Gort was nowhere in sight. One of the Indian women stood behind the bar, while a man the blood brothers hadn't seen before sat at one of the tables playing solitaire with a deck of greasy cards. The man's lower left leg was splinted and heavily bandaged, and propped up on another chair as he laid out the cards and took an occasional pull on a bottle of whiskey. That would be one of the men Alice Fletcher mentioned, Matt thought, the one who broke his leg in a scuffle. One of Deuce Mallory's gang. Knowing he was this close to a man who had taken part in the raid on Buckskin made Matt want to pull one of his colts and ventilate the son of a bitch. Patience wasn't Matt Bodine's strong suit. Whenever he had to wait for something, time dragged. But eventually, the sun went down and night settled over West Texas. The other man left behind by the gang came downstairs and joined his fellow Owl Hoot. This hombre's shoulder was bandaged, and his left arm rode in a sling. Both of the outlaws glanced at Matt and Sam from time to time, but didn't seem to recognize them or pay much attention to them. No other hard cases rode in during the afternoon, a good thing. Matt and Sam already faced a big enough challenge without the odds against them increasing. Van Gort came in and lit several lamps in the barroom.
Jovan some supper, my friends, yeah?
That'll be fine, much obliged.
One of the Indian women went upstairs carrying a pot of stew. Matt supposed that would be supper for the prisoners. He and Sam gave each other barely discernible nods. It was time.
I think I'll go check on the horses again before I eat.
Matt nodded and made no move to get up. It didn't really matter who set the fire and who remained inside. Each would face their own set of dangers. Van Gort paid no attention as Sam went out, but Matt figured that wasn't really the case. The Dutchman struck him as a man who didn't miss much, but Van Gort had no reason to suspect them of wanting to cause trouble. The man's business was providing sanctuary for outlaws, and they gave him no reason to think they were anything else. Time continued to slip by with maddening slowness after Sam left. Matt took a sip of his beer. It was flat now and hadn't been that good to start with. Then what he had been waiting for happened.
Fire! The barn's on fire!
Sam Two Wolves could see almost as well in the dark as a cat. A few minutes earlier, as he ambled across the courtyard inside the compound toward the barn and the corral, he saw tiny pinpoints of orange.